Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we welcome back Checkmate of Check on Chain, the best on-chain publication that we have access to right now. Check, welcome back to the show.
G'day, mate. Thanks for having me back on.
Of course. Now, Check, we're going to go through a lot of charts, both on market conditions and then on-chain themselves. And what we love to chat with you about are really both of these fields. The reason that we do them is because the Bitcoin blockchain gives us signal from actual transaction data that we're able to observe, as well as the other market structure metrics that we have access to, like funding rate or like ETF inflows. These are all things that you watch as well, because we have to marry the analysis of really all the information that we have access to. You look at futures markets, derivatives markets, you're looking at on-chain, and you're trying to combine all of these things to make a cohesive picture. So we're going to unpack your charts from your latest couple letters. I'll let you plug that right at the beginning, and then we'll go right into your monthly candles. We always love the when in doubt, zoom out. So talk to us about the monthly candles on the Bitcoin chart.
Yeah, absolutely. And it very much comes down to Bitcoin as a dynamic beast. And I think a good way to think about the on-chain data, it's kind of the fabric that glues together all of these other markets. So coins have to flow in and out of a derivatives exchange, in the ETFs. And all of these, you know, on-chain is the way that Bitcoin transfers between these entities, but it's also how people who are just buying spot express their view. So in many ways, you've kind of got all these different data sets. They very often speak the same language. But as Bitcoin becomes more dynamic, more financialized, we have to look at all these different markets side by side to get a comprehensive picture. And as I said, they often tell the same language if you know what you're looking for. So the chart that I did, or the letter that I did yesterday, was really trying to assess, and it starts big picture, right? Most of the time when you hear people say zoom out, it's because we've got a couple of nasty red candles and people are panicking. They're like, don't worry, if I zoom out, I can't see these red candles. So I tried to flip the script. We've had a fairly substantial bounce. We were at 54,000 2 weeks ago. During that time, the German government was offloading 38,000 Bitcoin. Here's actually a quick fun fact. They had 48,000 to sell. They sold them over a period of 1 month. In the first 3 weeks, they sold 10,000 of them. And interestingly, the market front ran their sell side. We went from in the 60,000s down to 53 before they even unloaded 20% of their total holdings. They then sold the remaining 38,000 and price actually rallied through it. So someone was there absorbing that supply. But anyway, we've rallied up to 68,000. And this is the time when I go, okay, let's actually zoom out and see what the monthly chart looks like. And the thing that really stood out to me is, I mean, when you really look at those monthly candlesticks, I've been talking about this concept of chop solidation, which is that we've had 18 months of upside from the FTX lows until the ETF high. When you have 18 months of upside, you probably need something in the order of 5, 6, 7 months of sideways. And right now we have, on a monthly scale, a beautiful, tight, very, very clean sideways monthly price action. So within that, there's a lot of weekly upswings, weekly downswings, there's liquidations, there's all sorts of stuff. But I did a report back in early April talking about chop solidation, and the price was 64,000. And I went back and looked at it. The conclusion from that report was, in April, hey, close your eyes for 6 months. We'll be at the exact same price, and there'll be a bunch of people getting liquidated on the long side, on the short side, and we'll have gone everywhere but nowhere at the same time. And lo and behold, when I look back at the other day, 64,000, and we've got traders liquidated on both sides. So in many ways, on a monthly scale, it's been a consolidation. But if you're zoomed in, it feels like we've been chopped around like crazy. So it's just that matter of perspective.
The Bitcoin Layer is presented by Unchained, the leader in Bitcoin financial services. Unchained empowers you to take full control of your Bitcoin with a collaborative multi-sig vault where you hold two of three keys and benefit from a Bitcoin security partner. Purchase Bitcoin directly into your cold storage and eliminate exchange risks with Unchained's trading desk. Unchained also offers the best IRA in the industry, easily allowing you to roll over your existing 401ks and IRAs into Bitcoin while still keeping control of your keys. Don't pay more in taxes than you have to. Talk to them today. Visit unchained.com/TBL and use code TBL for $100 off when you create an account. Now, I want to talk about this choppiness index that you have on the bottom pane. But first, I want to get to a question that I was seeing out there yesterday, which is, how can you get a single day of inflows like we had without the price going up? And I didn't publicly, you know, respond to this yet, but I want to get your take and explain that to people. Maybe I'll pre-answer it. Explain why one demand flow or one sell order doesn't linearly move the price by that amount. It's because the information is known over longer periods, and it's also combined with all other forces in the market. Explain to people why, when they look at the data that said, hey, BlackRock just got,
$520 million.
Yeah, $500 million inflow in one day. Why doesn't the price go up that day?
Absolutely. And there is a whole lot of dynamics here. And it's something that I'm a big advocate for my subscribers. I just try to emphasize markets are very big. They're very big. They're very dynamic. And more often than not, people who are inexperienced with markets, they do. They expect, hey, I saw this piece of information. Why is it not reflected in the price? And I've seen a bunch of people saying the same thing. It's like, but why are we dumping? And I was like, but we're at 54K 2 weeks ago, guys. What do you mean we're dumping? Like, we've seen net inflows to the ETFs over a period of time. The market has rallied. We got to 68,000, right? But these things, they take time. You've probably experienced this, right? I think everyone tries their hand at trading at some point in time. And you come up with this good thesis, right? You find a metric or an indicator. You're like, hey, look, this looks really bullish. We're seeing inflows. We're seeing X, Y, and Z. And you put on a trade and it goes against you. You get wiped out. And then it does what you thought it was going to do just 2, 3, 4 days later. Now, in terms of the ETFs, it's a dynamic market. I had a look at the open interest for CME particularly. Open interest for what I would call like the crypto native exchanges, the Binances and the Bybits. It's actually relatively flat. It's been pretty much the same level since October last year. CME is now at an all-time high, 171,000 Bitcoin of open interest. It's now by far the biggest gorilla in the room, 33% market share or 32%. Binance is now down to 22%. So CME is huge. And a large portion of what I see as the ETF inflows is going to be the basis trade. And this is people who are essentially shorting the future, longing the spot. There's other dynamics where you get a $500 million inflow. Not all of that is going to be basis trade. Some is going to be directional. But at the same time, somebody was selling those coins. Where do the authorized participants go and actually get those coins? There's going to be OTC. There's going to be exchange. For them to buy that 7,000 Bitcoin, someone sold 7,000 Bitcoin. And the only question is, at what price? There's also like T plus one settlement. When do they actually place the trade and buy the Bitcoin to cover the physical? There's all of these dynamics. And I think generally speaking, looking at things on a one-to-one basis, even if it doesn't quite make sense, look at things in terms of the trend. Don't worry so much about individual daily candles. What we have at the moment is the last 2 weeks have been inflows, 2.2 billion into the ETS. We had another $500 million yesterday. That is a trend. We now have a progressive trend of inflows, and price has gone from 54 to 68. So that's the story over that 2.5 week period. That's what's going on. Individual days, I would recommend just not getting too hung up on this day must do this. Separate what you think should happen from what is actually happening.
Absolutely. We're going to talk about the basis trade a little bit more. Cash and carry is something that we've discussed in previous episodes. Talk to us about this choppiness index. How did you create it? What's in it? And what's the signal going back to this monthly chart?
Yeah, so the choppiness index is one of the only, in fact, it is the only technical indicator that I use. And I learned about it from my market mentor, Doc Severson, back in the, several years ago. And what I love about it, I don't know what it is, something about just the way I like to look at markets. I like when things are non-directional, right? Because it forces me to then, as an engineer, I'm like, I need to understand which thing is driving the market. So what the choppiness index is, the best way to think about like a fuel tank. When the market trends, so if you kind of imagine a candlestick chart, look over a 14-day period or 14-week, 14-month, whatever your time frame is, over a 14-day period, how many of those candles are in the same range, right? So if you're trending, markets can only trend for so long. They become tired, they become exhausted, and the market has to consolidate or correct. So what happens is the choppiness index helps me gauge when on a monthly scale or a weekly scale or a daily scale, we've trended long enough that it's time for a rest, right? The market just needs to consolidate and correct. Now, when it consolidates and trades sideways, that's literally chopping around, chopping wood, moving sideways. More and more candles are going to be inside the same trading range. Now, a correction actually recharges the choppiness index faster because you've trended in one direction. You're now trending in the opposite direction. So therefore, more candles are within the last 14 days of trading range. So there's a few ways to kind of conceptualize this. There is nothing quite like, if you want to go higher, the best way to do that is actually to go lower first, because the price pulls back. People who are on the sidelines go, that's my opportunity. Now I'm going to step in. Their dollars go further per the asset that they're buying. So lower prices actually can be the catalyst to go higher. Likewise, consolidation ranges help people kind of reestablish and build support, get confidence. There's all these different mechanics, but it's essentially a fuel tank. And what I've been talking about when I spoke about this chop solidation, on the monthly scale, this is like the aircraft carrier. It takes a long time to turn that thing around. It's got a huge amount of inertia. It's also immune to the waves. It just keeps powering along. So on a monthly basis, we are in a long-term uptrend, but we're going to have weekly scale corrections within that. So that's a weekly downtrend followed by a weekly uptrend, followed by a weekly downtrend. If you zoom out to the monthly, it's sideways. If you zoom into the 1 hourly chart, you're getting thrown around like a speedboat in the waves. So it's all about just trying to ground your perspective and understand, is the aircraft carrier in control? Because at some point, the 1 hour chart will reverse. Then the 4 hour will reverse, and then the daily. And sometimes that does deteriorate to the point where the monthly actually turns around. So choppiness index helps me understand, is it a normal correction? Should I be expecting it? Or should I be actually looking for something a little bit more, you know, am I expecting chop or trending?
So talk to us about this Bitcoin spot cumulative volume delta chart. You have some indications here that the German government distribution at $100 million to $150 million a day was a drag in the beginning, but then you referenced that actually a lot of that maybe was priced in advance when we're talking about those last 75% of the coins. So walk us through what you're looking at here with the volume delta.
Yes. So actually, there was a very good question from our Substack that was saying, well, how can we have negative or sell side dominant CVD and the market trend higher? This doesn't make sense. So let's just break down what the CVD actually is. Whenever, if you've kind of bought any kind of asset, there's a limit order and there's a market order. Market means you're hitting the bid or hitting the ask. You're actually taking liquidity from the books. Limit orders are you're sitting there waiting for somebody to come to you. So what the CVD looks at is all those market orders, what was the net bias? Was there, you know, if you had $2 million worth of buy side and $1 million of sell side, you'd have a net $1 million on the buy side direction, positive, and vice versa. Now, what we've seen recently over the really the last couple of months, it's been net sell side. And people say, well, why didn't the price technically did go down, but why didn't it crash to zero? It's like, because you got to remember, who are those market sellers? Who are they hitting? Who are they selling to? Limit orders. So the best way to think about this is, and we have flipped over into the positive now, it's moved into the green. That's now telling us that after the German government, who was essentially market selling, and they released a report saying, yes, we've actually completed the sale. Who did they sell to? And this is actually a concept I've had running in the back of my mind. I keep seeing evidence to justify this. The 2023 to 24 uptrend has been quite remarkable in the sense that we haven't had very steep drawdowns. It's been very light in terms of volatility. We've kind of seen this just slow and steady climb. Internally, on the 1 hour charts, choppy. On the macro scale, it's just been a beautiful structured uptrend. There's been some group of entities, hodlers, smart money, institutions, whoever they are, who is sitting there in the limit books, just allowing the market to come to them. They're not doing what the average hodler would do and just hitting market buy, right? They're not hitting at any price. They're allowing the market to come and sell to them rather than buy from the market. And this is a very interesting dynamic because I don't recall seeing this kind of structure before. Obviously, it happens at times, but it's been very consistent that the market has had this support floor under it where people are just allowing the market to come to them. They're patient. They feel sophisticated, and they're just allowing the market to give them their price rather than taking the price off somebody else. So that's kind of the dynamic here. But after the German government finished their sell side, we did see it flip into the net buy side regime, which is, you know, associated with the current rally. We have to be careful because you get too many people market buying. It's kind of like liquidations. These are people who are literally get me in at any price. It's that like speculative that can only go for so long. But nevertheless, it's kind of a clear regime shift in the near term.
It's a really interesting point. A sign of market maturation. This is one of the themes in all of our conversations. The maturation leads to slightly compressed volatility, another theme. And I want to talk about compressed volatility real quick, because the last several conversations that we've had, it's all about, hey, the drawdowns just haven't been there. Well, we finally got one that I think it was about 28%. Check
about
if
that.
I'm, if I'm,
yeah, it was about that.
Yeah. So not quite 30, definitely more than 25. We had a few that were in that 20 to 25 range. So the largest one of this current cycle, 28%, now step back. We've recovered, you know, most of that price. What is your thought about the 28% correction that we experienced? Is that, was it classic? Is it probably, or maybe not done yet in as we continue to chop? Or did you see something happen in the market? Maybe I'm skipping ahead on a chart here, but I just wanted to get your big picture thoughts on compressed vol.
Yeah, I think the really, I had a chart in one of my previous reports that was looking at the German government sell side. That's what I was referring to before. What was really quite fascinating about it is we had the net, the market sold off. I can't remember exactly what the price was from, but it was from the 60,000s down to 54 or wherever he bottomed. Most of the sell side was done over the 3 weeks where the German government released 10,000 of their 48,000 Bitcoin. So a small portion of their total outflows. And then once they got to there's about a week or 8 days where they unloaded 38,000. And it was just like a precipitous drop, literally day after day. Sometimes it was $600 million just daily sell side. So really quite tremendous. And the market actually, on an intraday basis, was setting higher highs and higher lows. So it was clearly absorbing that volume, but it wasn't cascade selling. The market actually front ran that. So when I look at this broad picture, if I just take a real zoomed out view and say, well, what has this correction been? We had one dip in April, which I think was about 20%. Then we had this one we're talking about in June, which got down to about 25, 26%. Through both of those, I keep coming back to this word structured, and maybe it's one of those things where you spend enough time with the data and price charts and you kind of feel that this doesn't feel like a bear market. It feels like there are people who are buying during these ranges. A lot of the on-chain metrics I track, MVRV and SOPA, they did exactly what you want them to do during a correction. They reset, they cool off. Particularly short-term SOPA, we have these beautiful like vertical undercuts, which means that people who bought high sell low. And as a contrarian, and I talk about this a lot on my Substack, the whole goal is to be the contrarian. On-chain data gives us this really unique lens where we can actually see what everyone else is doing. And the reality is, I don't particularly want to buy my Bitcoin at a high price when a bunch of guys are locking in profits. I want to wait for the guy who did buy to then see price fall down below his cost basis, start to panic, and then finally capitulate, because people do this all at the same time, very herd mentality. Show me when top buyers are taking the L, that's when I want to buy the dip. And we've seen these like beautiful mini capitulations and then a recovery. And this is what you want to see in a bull market. This is like structured bull market behavior. So as it stands, I've not seen anything that's kind of broken the bull market structure. As always, you want to remain vigilant just to see, but so far it actually looks really, really quite robust. And, you know, until I see evidence to the contrary, that's my view.
TBL pros are receiving our Monday report called Mean Median Mode. It's our new quantitative risk report. And we have this nice little scale showing where we believe Bitcoin is in its cycle. So going from early bear to mid bear to late bear, then early bull, mid bull, and late bull. We actually believe we are still right in the middle of this mid bull. Mm-hmm. I know you might think maybe early or mid bull, depending on you know, some of your metrics, but I definitely don't feel qualitatively like we're in a late bull cycle yet. That bubble type of mentality just isn't present yet. We don't have that fluff and grandma buying Bitcoin on the cover of newspapers. I want to talk really quickly about, just reinforce this idea of limit orders absorbing market selling before we go to the next chart. So these large red areas below the axis here on the bottom pane, it's suggesting that you have more market sell orders than buy orders. And if the price is stabilized, it means that the limit orders beneath the market are absorbing all of the selling. And add one more dynamic in there, which is that the limit orders being there and actually being of size to absorb the selling indicates something important about the market structure on the demand side. It just means the demand is there and it's set in advance. It's not panic buying like you might have seen in previous bull market cycles, because this is a different type of bull market. It's a different type of asset in 2024 than it was in 2016.
It's quite distinctly not a bear as well, because in a bear market, the reason price goes down is that there isn't that support. So the sell side overwhelms and the price has to go down to a new level before it finds that demand. So it's very much a market characteristic. You become used to seeing, like, that's interesting. And the other thing that's really important about this, it's all about your cost basis. It's about where is the investor cost basis. And I've been talking about this on my Substack quite a bit, because I'm a big advocate for, I have no idea what the future is. We could be in a bear market and we only know after the fact. But at the same time, let's just run a thought experiment. Let's imagine we do go into a bear market and price goes down to 40,000, right? For whatever reason. I would much rather have bought the dip at 57 and 53 and then go to 40 than be holding coins I bought at 73 and then go down to 40, right? So having people absorbing this supply at the bottom of these corrections, even if price gets back down to them, they're more likely to, hey, I saw value in this at this price 2 weeks ago. Yeah, that's a second bite of the cherry. I'll take it. Hey, you're giving me a 10% discount to where I previously thought was good value. I'll take that as well. Now, I mean, of course, if it keeps going lower, people panic, but I would rather people be panicking from 53K at 40 than people panicking from 73, where you've got, you know, 90% of the supplies up there and people just start cascading out. So that's a big psychological element as well.
Absolutely. And that's a great point there about it being a bull market because the limit orders are there. If it was a bear market, they wouldn't actually have orders in advance ready to catch the market, because that's not a sign of a bull market. So if I had a bell, we would be ringing it there for you, Chek. Let's go to the next chart on Bitcoin ETF inflows. So very healthy over the last couple weeks. They're coming back, and it is corresponding with the price coming back, just like you said, not on a single day to single day basis, but the last 2 weeks we have a trend.
Absolutely. I mean, and over the last 2 weeks and one day, right, because it's obviously Monday to Friday, it'd be about 2.7 billion, I think, because it was 2.2 for the last 2 weeks, and then we had half a billion yesterday. So 2.7 billion. I think the real takeaway from this chart, you can probably see in the background, there's the price. And I've actually got overlaid there the average ETF cost basis. This is like looking at when the inflows occurred, right? It's never going to be a perfect model, but it's giving us an idea of where that average inflow price was. And from memory, it's about 58.2. And there's been a lot of analysts out there, particularly TradFi analysts, saying, hey, when the price sells off below their cost basis, these ETF investors are going to be weak hand, orange poker chip sellers. And what we actually saw is that the German government unloaded $600 to $400 million per day sell side, and the ETFs saw 2.7 billion of inflows. So we actually saw the exact opposite behavior to what the classic TradFi analysts would expect. We've seen people step in and actually buy below their cost basis. So for those who follow my work, I'll talk about the short-term holder cost basis all the time. The ETFs have only been around for 6 months. So, you know, we talk about a five-month time frame for short-term holders. So essentially, the ETFs functioned exactly the same as the short-term holder cost basis. People stepped in and bought when it came below their average cost basis. So that is short-term holder behavior. That's what we look for in a bull. Again, just more and more evidence that we have that support bull market structure.
That's right. And we've been covering short-term holder realized, and that ratio did fall below one. It recovered one, which means short-term holders are back in the green on their trades. And so let me just ask, so I can understand this ETF cost basis line that you have in this chart, this is a model that you built or you are pulling it from somewhere. How is this number being calculated? Is it
daily? It's essentially an inflow weighted price. So look at all of the net inflows. So it includes GBTC's outflows as a counterforce. But it's essentially what is the net inflow, the average price at which those coins, well, that dollar has gone in.
And it's your metric?
Yeah, correct.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, because I want to start comparing that metric to short-term holder realized and see, you know, because this is a great point. If the ETFs are their own little market structure and their own segmentation of the market, then the price going below, and if they're a dominant force, they should be buying that level. And so that's fascinating.
And that's a great example of looking at on-chain and ETFs. And I mean, in theory, you could do it like volume weighted for futures, and you can look for all these areas and you start building a really nice comprehensive picture. I think the beauty of this is we have this data. You just don't have this in most TradFi assets. I mean, some people do with the Bloomberg terminal, but that's pretty much it. A lot of the market data for Bitcoin is remarkably transparent, which is fantastic.
Absolutely. Now, the next chart we have is perpetual funding of Bitcoin. And I want to bring back cash and carry in the basis trade real quick so that people really understand what we're talking about now in this Bitcoin market. It goes back to the first question I asked you about one day's ETF demand driving the price or not. We are, ladies and gentlemen, in a new era of Bitcoin in which we have spot exchanges, we have futures exchanges, we have a CME behemoth of a futures market, we have ETFs. And within all of those markets, they're all different segments. You can think about overseas buyers being on futures exchanges on native crypto exchanges. You can talk about domestic US buyers being in the ETF market. You can talk about US hedge funds being in the basis trade using CME and ETFs. And you can talk about people in Europe or in Asia being in the basis trade, being long spot on Kraken and being short the futures on Binance, perpetual futures. So what I'm trying to establish here before I ask you this question for the audience is that you have buyers and sellers in all types of markets, and then you have hedged players doing the basis trade as well in all the type of markets. So trying to figure out where the price is going to go based off of one metric is a suicide run. We look at perpetual funding because it gives us good signal. It definitely is going to tell us when the market is overheated, for example. But looking at these metrics in isolation misses the fact that we have basis trades and we have a bunch of different segments of buyers in the market spread out throughout the world. So we have to take every single metric with a grain of salt, especially just looking at cash and carry metrics like funding. So sorry for the extended rant, but I'll turn it over to you. You can respond to what I'm saying and then walk us through what you're seeing with the funding rate. And this is a look at funding over the last few years. So it's not just a zoomed in look at the last couple of weeks.
No, I couldn't agree more with what you just said. I think it really is that dynamic mark. And we do have to look at all these things in combination. And you know, that's why I keep relating it back to my engineering experience as a ground engineer, because as a ground engineer, you have very, very incomplete information. You've got four boreholes, they're 50 mil diameter, and you've got to design a 50 by 50 square meter, 30 meter deep hole. It's a whole different ball game, right? You're dealing with fractions of a percent of information, but you've got to stitch together what's going on in between. Now, we have a lot more than fractions of a percent worth of data. We can see a lot of this stuff. So something I've been playing around with recently, I like that you broke apart CME futures and the perpetual swaps. First thing, there's no question in my mind that we will see perpetual swaps. I think BitMEX invented those. they will migrate over to the traditional finance world. There's a 100% chance because it's just an absolutely fantastic instrument. Very, very clever in how it was developed. So generally speaking, as it stands today, Binance, Bybit, these are kind of OKX. These are kind of the big, let's call them crypto native exchanges, mostly dominated by perpetual swaps. Perpetuals are by far the biggest crypto native derivative instrument. In the CME, they are what's called calendar, right, or expiring futures. They have a December contract and an August contract and a February contract. So with the basis trade, it's more or less the same thing. The futures market, you essentially buy spot. Now, that spot can be either literally physical Bitcoin, spot from Coinbase or Binance or whatever, but you can also buy the ETFs now. So you've got two different vehicles to buy spot, and then you sell the future. Now, what that does is it's locking in a premium. If you're doing a basis trade on the CME, you hold that position, long spot, short future. Usually the future is higher. Literally think about it. I bought the ETF today at 68K. I'm selling it in the future at 70. If I hold those positions until that point, I lock in a $2,000 premium, annualize it, so on and so forth. Funding rates are more dynamic. They move literally second by second. It's like a dynamic interest rate. Now, a really important dynamic that's probably useful for people to understand, for the trader, this is neutral. I am long spot, I am short future. To exit that trade, I sell spot and I buy future. Now, this is where things get kind of interesting. So for the trader, they don't care where the market goes because they're hedged. They're perfectly delta neutral. For the market, it can be directional. Now, what do I mean by this? Spot markets are much smaller. The ETF market is much smaller than the futures market. So if you are buying an ETF and you are selling the futures market will take that sell side, no problem. Likewise, when you exit the trade, when you buy back the future, it'll just absorb, right? Multi-$100 million positions can just go in and out of these. In the ETF and the spot market, if you long $500 million worth of Bitcoin, you have to sell $500 million worth of Bitcoin. So I will often look at the difference in the trade volume between these two. I know the futures market will probably absorb that entry and exit without too much worry. But if you have to exit the basis trade, which for you as a trader is neutral, when you sell the spot, you may be hitting a thinner order book. So you can in fact have some kind of a downswing. So, and in that instance, if you are selling the spot and it's thin and the market may go lower, you may close your futures short later because you know that you're putting sell side into the spot market. Price could go down, your short will benefit, and then you close the future. So there is these like in market versus internal dynamics that are quite interesting, quite complex. It's also why getting really into the minutiae is probably a very low alpha sport, but understanding that these things are in play, probably much more useful. And one last point I'll put on this, for the basis trade to exist, there is a bullish bias, right? Because there is a premium on the futures. So the fact that this basis trade exists and it exists on every asset that's big enough to have a futures market, the fact that it exists means there's actually a net bullish bias to Bitcoin, which is good, right? It's net positive, but there are these kind of nuanced dynamics at play.
We're talking about intentional and unintentional slippage of the basis trade closeout. Is that what you're referring
to
there? That's
it, essentially.
Okay. Okay, so let's go to the next chart here. You have the term structure of, well, actually, before we do that, let's just talk about funding over the last few weeks. Where has funding gotten to? What are you taking away from just the perpetual funding market interest
yes.
rate?
Yeah, sorry, we missed that. So on the funding rate, that's the crypto native side. That's mostly going to be the Binances and the Bybits. I would say, based on my, I think it's like 8% annualized. And a lot of these exchanges have like a minimum. So if there's not really any bias in either direction, it defaults to, I forget what the exact number is, but it kind of comes out in the wash to be somewhere about 8% at the moment. So it looks like the bull market baseline. There's not any kind of excessive leverage. It doesn't feel speculative. Generally speaking, I'm not seeing any kind of signs of it being overheated. That's net positive. You mentioned the term structure in the CME side of the equation. We've got about a 10% premium. And that's, again, because you've kind of got one big environment, the CME. So, but again, if you think about those two numbers, 8% annualized in funding rates, 10% in CME, the risk-free rate is 5.5% from treasuries. So you're essentially getting two times the yield. Now, in theory, you have to have the buy spot short futures. So you need twice as much capital. That means that the basis trade, if you have no leverage and all that kind of stuff, if you're just doing it kind of base spot cash and carry, you're getting about the same as the risk-free rate. That's neutral. I mean, the risk-free rate is the neutral rate. So we're kind of in that ballpark where there's an incentive enough to do it, but there's not really an incentive to really pile this thing on and get, you know, ridiculously large. So it is really in that neutral level, very, very little speculative premium as it stands, kind of aligns with that mid-bull type thesis.
Yes. And just for the audience to understand, if you really want to get into the minutiae here, if you are going long Bitcoin ETFs with leverage, not in a basis trade, your short, your carry cost is the risk-free rate, basically your funding rate. It's going to be similar to Treasury repo because that's the rate that's charged on margin collateral for these types of buyers. They post treasuries to their margin broker and they're able to borrow at the repo rate, SOFR. This is not SOPR, but SOFR, which is just a way to index treasury repo. My point is that embedded in all of these markets, there's the other side of the borrow. And the borrow side in ETF land, whether you're buying SPOOs or you're buying NASDAQ or you're buying Bitcoin ETFs, your carry cost from a dollar perspective is the Fed's policy rate, essentially. So it's interesting to think about the basis trade. And because the reason I mention is because you bring up capital, the cost of capital. Well, if you're doing a Bitcoin basis trade, you should have the capital to buy the ETF so that you don't have to pay a borrow on the capital. And that way you have dedicated capital. Then you can actually go short the futures with much less capital. That way giving people a little bit of a pickup here. We're on this term structure chart, 10% in that annualized basis trade, but some of that carry might not be accessible to every market participant. And so that's why the hedge funds are getting involved. They can get involved without basically dedicating two times the capital. They can do it with one plus, right? One plus a little bit. So moving to the next one, check, we'll go to the euphoria zone. These blue and green, off-green regions are areas in which MVRV is above standard deviation or more to its average or to the MVRV itself, right? I have that.
Yeah, so the green zones are actually when we're setting new all-time highs in price every 90 days. However, the reason I do the chart the way it is it's actually showing that that is also the point in time when MVRV gets to a statistically meaningful level. So what does that otherwise mean? People are in a statistically meaningful amount of unrealized profit. Your portfolio is very green. It's green enough that people start going, that's a nice number. And ironically enough, that seems to be when we bust through to new all-time highs, new liquidity flows in, everyone gets very excited. That's why I call it the euphoria zone, because you've actually got price getting into that new price discovery. And I would argue we kind of touched it, but we haven't really gone into price discovery yet. So once we do, we will also have a lot of investors that are in a meaningful amount of profit, and this creates the dynamic, right? Things get more volatile, things go up a lot, but then they pull back a lot more too. So you get that volatility start to creep in.
And we're waiting for that. We really are. And we're patient for the breakout above 75, let's just say 75 to 90 or 75 to 100. That is a move that we're expecting, but we're willing to be patient for it because we know that it's going to have a volatility that accompanies it. And so the longer it takes for the realized price of Bitcoin, or let's say the more time that goes by, the higher the realized price of Bitcoin can go, leading to a scenario in which MVRV isn't reaching astronomical levels upon the breakout. And so you and I are looking at MVRV in a similar way. We're looking for the bounce. We're looking for the stabilization. And I think that we've seen that here over the last 2 weeks. We bounced off of, if I remember correctly, about 1.8 and are back above 2. So really looking well. And I track realized price every day, watch it tick up towards 30, 31,000 now. and just looking at a market that's mid bull. I mean, that's just the way I'm characterizing it. So what are your thoughts
there? Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about what MVRV is, it's market value, market cap or spot price divided by realized value, realized cap or realized price. So if you think about this as a two components, obviously price we all understand goes up and down, left, right, and sideways. If you look at the denominator, that's the capital inflows. In order to lift the realized cap, someone has to sell a coin from 30,000 and revalue it to a new buyer at 68. That represents a capital inflow. Someone had to come in with more money to buy that previously valued $30,000 coin at 68. So when the realized price is climbing, that means that money came into Bitcoin. True measurable liquidity has come into BTC. So it is one guy's sell side, it's another guy's buy side. One guy's cost basis increases, another guy is exiting the market. So the higher that the higher that realized price goes in the denominator, the more it cools off MVRV, and it does. It pours a foundation for the next move. The longer we stay up here, the more capital comes in and absorbs that supply, and it creates a much, much healthier environment. So as Bitcoiners, we get used to patience, right? It's part of the game. I always find it interesting. It's a game of perspective. Some people are saying, why isn't Bitcoin higher? It's like, guys, we're up 350% since like a year and a half ago. This is one of the best performing assets in the world. In fact, I've got a chart that tracks Bitcoin versus the Mag 7. Yesterday, we overtook Tesla, only NVIDIA since March 2020. NVIDIA is the only asset that is above Bitcoin's performance. And we just overtook Tesla, who had a tremendous run in 2021 and has been giving back that ever since. It is really, really hard for any asset or any index to sustainably beat BTC. This is just the way that the data is playing out. We don't know if that's going to be the same moving forward, but it's been like that for a long time. So Bitcoin's kind of that hurdle rate.
We'll look forward to the Bitcoin NVIDIA convergence here over the next couple months or years or however long it takes. Chek, I just wanted to mention one thing that we're telling our readers is at thebitcoinlayer.com/subscribe. We're telling them that MVRV and realized price, the way to think of these things, you're mentioning capital inflow. We're calling it your cold storage price. So let's combine the two explanations that you have into one. Chek is telling us that realized price is this capital invested. And so think about that capital. If it comes onto a Bitcoin exchange and the Bitcoin doesn't come to cold storage, it hasn't actually been capital invested. It's capital that's being held somewhere. If the Bitcoin that's purchased with that capital then comes to your cold storage, that's what Chek is referring to as capital invested, because now it's actually being stored by you and the dollars are not accessible unless you actually bring them back, those coins back to the market. Whereas if you're leaving it on the exchange, you haven't sent them into cold storage, and the capital that you've dedicated can leave right away. So in that way, it's not truly invested capital yet. It's just more temporary capital. And these two numbers, the market price, which is all that temporary capital, and the realized price, which is your invested capital or your cold storage price, that's what creates the multiple. You have the price and you have the cold storage price. And as that multiple expands, the cold storage coins are likely to come back into the market and achieve that profit. So
MVRV is the incentive for people to sell. It's the thing that the greener your portfolio gets, the more you're like, oh, that's starting to get into a big number. Maybe I'll take some chips off the table. It's the incentive.
That's right. So I just wanted to let you know how we're explaining it to our audience. Because I even had people coming up to me, man, you talk about realized price almost every week now, but I still don't get it. So I don't shy away from trying to find different ways to explain it, because people really, they have to understand this metric, because it's the root of all Bitcoin valuation. If you can understand this concept of cold storage price versus the market price. So
imagine you withdrew a coin back in 2019. If you've got a UTXO that's just gone into your cold card, you've not moved it since, that's going to be saved. That you invested, let's just say you bought one Bitcoin at $10,000. You invested $10,000. You withdrew it to your cold card and it still sits there. that coin is saved at that price. Now, when you go to sell it and you send it back to an exchange, and there's a whole different topic about like, oh, but hang on a second, I didn't actually sell it, or I bought it at 12,000. Yeah, but some other guy bought it at 8,000. It's the error bars are small. But the point is, you've saved that coin and it's going to be held. Every single coin has a realized price. So when we talk about the realized price, it's the average over everybody. We may also say the short-term holder realized price. Show me only people who bought recently because they're sensitive, right? And I use this thought experiment. Can you tell me what your average cost basis was from 2 years ago? I got no idea. I have to go and look at spreadsheets and whatever. If I ask you what's your cost basis from your last purchased coin, you're going to be much, much more accurate. And if price sells off, you're going to go, oh man, I really should have waited. I could have got it 10% cheaper. You instinctively react to your short-term holder cost basis. Even if most of your wealth is in old UTXOs, your most recent one is going to be the one that stings the most when price does something.
Absolutely. Now let's talk about short-term holder SOPR. You mentioned the big washout that you loved to see. I believe this is that chart. So now walk us through what happened here on the drawdown to 54.
Yeah, so where we talk about MVRV, which is the unrealized profit or loss, how in the green or red are the coins that people hold? SOPR is the sister metric of that. It is show me the value of all the coins that were spent. So if somebody's coin is from 10,000 and they're selling it at 50,000, they're going to lock in a 400% multiple, right? That's their profit taking. So SOPR is telling us what is changing in that profit and loss landscape. Now, the way that I use SOPR, and actually I'm going to be talking about, this is going to be the bones of what I talk about at my presentation at the Bitcoin conference. It's showing my journey of what I didn't know back in 2018, where the market would sell off and I go, oh shit, I got to get out because it's going lower. And I'd sell and of course it would rip higher. Oh man, I missed the bottom. I guess now's the time to buy. And then it would sell off again. What's really going on under the surface? Somebody is taking profit and I'm buying coins because I feel good. The market's going up. I feel good this is how humans like the natural response. I feel good about buying because the price is going up. What I don't realize is that there's a bunch of smart money who are selling and taking profits and dumping on my head. And I'm buying at the exact wrong time. When you have these mini capitulations, it's because you felt good when you bought it. Price is now down 20% from where you bought it. You're feeling pretty horrible about it. You're checking Twitter and you go, oh man, all my favorite traders are saying it's going to zero. I guess I should sell and buy back lower. And what you're doing is the same as what every other, you know, less sophisticated, less people who don't spend all the time in the data. We all do this. This is very crowd behavior. We all have the same reaction. Go, oh, don't worry, I'll buy back lower. And we all sell. And that's usually the crowd mini capitulation. So in a bull market, the general rule for how you want to understand both short-term SOPR and short-term MVRV, they work together. I don't want to buy my Bitcoin or my DCA when both of those metrics are high, because that means people are in profit and they're taking profit. We're more likely to get a consolidation or a correction at that point in time. What I want to see is the people who didn't listen to that advice, who do buy when short-term SOPR and short-term MVRV are high, they're buying some guy's profit. They're going to ride that wave to the bottom of the correction. And I want to see short-term SOPR and short-term MVRV as close to or below one as possible. That's like a mini capitulation. And at the very least, even if the market goes lower, I would much rather have bought my DCA at 57 and 56 and 53. Even if we do go down to 40, I can deal with that. What I don't want is to have bought at 73 and be down at 40 and be like, wow, what a mistake. So it just helps improve your cost basis by watching the less sophisticated actors. When SOPR's high, probably not a great time. When SOPR pulls down to one and goes below, much, much better.
If you guys are looking for that type of minutia analysis, definitely check out Check on Chain, the new Substack from Check. Actually, it's not so new now. It's starting to become, I think, a lot of people's just go-to place for a signal in a very noisy world. So we thank you for your letter and keep writing that. And we look forward to continuing to read what you have there. Finish this lecture here with the sell side risk ratio. Explain to us what you saw here over the last couple weeks this blue low risk zone is where the market is now ready to move back higher. What is this metric? What goes into it, and what's the signal?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite metrics, and it really does live alongside MVRV and SOPA. They're just super, super powerful. The way to think about the sell side risk ratio, and it actually calls back to our choppiness index. It's a directionless metric. It doesn't tell you whether we're going up or down. So it's a ratio, and it looks at all the realized profit and all the realized loss in the numerator, and it compares it to how big the market cap is, or the realized cap. So another way to think about this, if it's a very low number, it means all of the coins that are moving around and being spent on chain, if we're at 68,000, it means those coins came from 70 or 65 or 67. They're coming from a small delta. Coins aren't locking in big profits, big losses. We've kind of reached equilibrium. And markets, when they reach equilibrium, they can stay there for a long time, but they want to move. They want to go to a new price range. If the price was to sell off, a bunch of people who bought at 60 are going to go, oh my God, that's it. I'm out. I'm going to sell everything. And they're going to lock in a big loss from 60 down to 40. Now you've got a spike. You've got people who believe the market is going somewhere else. So you've got an unstable equilibrium, right? It's destabilized from where it was. We typically see sell side risk trend much higher during bull markets because the guys who bought at $200 and $2,000 and $10,000 are selling at 40, 60, 70. They're taking big profit. So generally speaking, sell side risk will trend into the higher risk zone. And if you think about what that's telling you, the more of those coins that are coming from 200, 2000 up to 60, 70, 80, 100, whatever the price is, that's sell side. That's coins that are now much more valuable and liquid circulating, right? Short-term supply is much bigger. Long-term holders are exiting. So it's telling you that we're getting closer and closer to a higher risk environment where that uptrend can reverse. In a bear market, you'll notice that like FTX bottoms and bear market bottoms, you get sharp, short, violent ticks higher, but then it recovers. That's telling you there's like a large scale top buyer capitulation. Also a high risk event if you're a short seller, right? Because we're now at an inflection point where we have exhausted sell side, the market is more likely to reverse in another trend. So to kind of summarize and bring back where we are, we've had 5 or 6 months of chop solidation. On a monthly scale, it's a big sideways compression. The honest truth is the monthly chart looks tremendous. It looks really, really good, but the market is ready to move. Now that doesn't tell us where it wants to go. It just tells us it wants to go. It's kind of done its job up here in this price range. There's a lot of things that point to the positive side, but the last thing I closed on in my letter yesterday is things look really good with one caveat. We are in a very strange world right now. As you know, anyone who looks at 5 minutes on the news, anything could happen. So my view is I feel very constructive. I've maintained a constructive composure for some time, but I am fastening my seatbelt because it's going to be a weird and wonderful ride to get there.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the demand characteristics and the support for the market using things that we're looking at, like global liquidity, the quantity of money in the banking system, the direction of interest rates, they all seem to be supportive to risk assets and potentially to Bitcoin. But you're right to point out that in a hectic world, you don't know what can shift the demand one way or the other. And so it makes us happy that we're not here operating a hedge fund and Absolutely. Instead a research publication. Checkmate, check on chain. Please tell people where they can find your excellent analysis. And thank you so much for joining us again on the Bitcoin Layer.
No, thanks, mate. Yeah, you'll find all of our work over at checkonchain.com. So we do have a newsletter. We do 2 a week. A little bit of educational stuff. We did a piece on how to understand short-term SOPA. And something that I've really enjoyed is this kind of two things. One is kind of speaking to myself. And I use this persona where it's like check the analyst and this check the hodler. And check the analyst does. I write the newsletter to help check the hodler make better decisions. And I know there's a lot of check the hodlers out there, right? So I'm not there to pick the next day. I use this line. I'm not going to predict the future because I don't know, but I can prepare for it, right? So even if we do get one of these events, the fact that I've done the mental loops to go, well, if we were to go down to this level, what would my decision be? So when it happens and I wake up and it's at 45,000, I'm not like, oh, what what do I do? I'm like, I've already done the mental loops to go, oh, that's my level. I'm going to step in and buy that with a bit more confidence. So that's really how I try to run it. It's all about check the analyst doing his best to try and help check the hodler make better decisions.
Understood. Check, mate. Thank you so much again, and we'll catch you guys next time.